Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Social Work Radio with me, your host, Vince Peart. Once again, we are joined by our co-host, Cara Davis. Cara, my friend, how the devil are you? How have things been since you were last aboard the good ship SWR?
I'm really good, actually. I think I've come off a week off annual leave. I feel light. I feel free. I'm ignoring my to-do list.
Excellent.
Standard. Went through all my emails. But I actually spent my last day of annual leave on the beach in a sea sauna.
What's a sea sauna? I know what a sea sauna is, but what is a sea sauna?
Sea sauna. So it's a sort of wooden sauna, you know, traditional wooden sauna with the wood fire, but it's like on the sea, and then you just run out into the sea to get your cold dip in between.
So the sea is the cold plunge.
Yeah, the sea is the cold plunge, which is a bit iffy when it's windy, but it was fine. Like, do a little plunge and refresh. But
how long is the walk? How far are these things?
Oh, it's on the sea, so like literally, you know, a few steps, a little run in. Yeah, so I went with a friend, and then we were in there with a group of other women. It feels like it's something that you go through. Like, men go through their midlife crisis and buy a sports car. Mm-hmm. Women sea swim. Like, that's just how it goes. But yeah, that was like my last day, and I felt like all fresh and anew, I felt good and all connected to the world. So I felt like I moved into my week back at work fine, light, airy, ready.
Do you rent these things by the hour? Is there a little attendant there? Do you rent them as a group? Is it communal? What's the deal? How does this? Hello, my name's Vince. I'm looking to get into sea saunering. What's the deal? What's the big idea?
So they feel like they've popped up all over the south coast of the UK recently. Nice. So I went to one in Brighton. That's very fancy.
What a surprise. The gentrified south coast of England is leading the way on a new fad. Colour me shocked.
It's like us and all like the gym bros with like their cold ice dip things.
Yeah, that's it.
There's a lot of them sort of spattered around the south coast, but there's one now in Portsmouth or Southsea. Mm-hmm. You rent it for an hour, well, 45 minutes normally, because then they do 15 minute like clean up in between. Yeah. And then you can have the whole one to yourself, or you like just buy a slot. So there's normally like six people in them. So then you like bond with other people that are also got nothing better to do with their Sunday mornings. They go for a sauna and a sea swim, but it's also attached to a cafe, which, you know, you can't then not have a sauna and then a lovely coffee and a bagel. But yeah, you just book it for like 45 minutes and feel fresh and anew. And I don't know, I loved it. Really loved it. Felt cool. Like it just, I don't know, like sat in the sauna, watching the sea and all the sort of nature around you. I mean, there is the dog walkers walking past, giving you a little wave. So you have to be somewhat comfortable with being in your swimming cozy in the middle of winter. But yeah, it felt great. I'm really into it. I've decided it's going to be my thing this year.
I think it sounds like an excellent idea. Are you aware of the concept of the third place?
No.
I'll tell you about this. I read about it yesterday. So you know far more than I do, and far more than probably most of our listeners, given that you work in mental health. You know that we are entering what Durkheim might have described as anomie. There are a lot of people in the world right now who feel a bit disaffected. Depending on which side of the bed you're on, either mental health issues are rising or mental health issues are simply becoming more readily diagnosed. But most people would agree that there is an escalation in mental health crisis, an escalation in depression, an escalation in drug use and suicidal actions and ideation. Would that be fair to assume that most people would genuinely agree that we are entering an era where more people are perhaps struggling with their mental health than any before? Would that be fair for me to say?
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more in where we are right now as a, like, culturally.
Yes. So there are many different reasons given for that. We've heard most of them, such as the proliferation of social media, the the slow death of religion, changing work patterns, changing sensibilities, the access to the wider world that means the whole of the world's evils are beamed into our devices. These doom-scrolling periods we have where we see all sorts of tragedy on our phones. People may also point to the fact that there are more separated families. There's lots and lots of different reasons. We've heard them all. One that I hadn't heard of before that I found really interesting, I read about, is the concept of a third place. So when we think of the generations before us, Cara, people usually had three key places where they would spend their life. Work, home, and some third place. Now, that might be a pub that people went to regularly. It might, might be a church. It might be a social club. Generally speaking, there was a communal third place that people would go to. The notion now is that we don't really have that third place. And for many people who are home working, they only really have one place. Now, the importance of that third place, or even that second place, if everybody's working from home, is decompression. So if you think about having three places, you've got a place where you rest, which is your home, safe haven. You've got a place which you work, which in an ideal world, that would be where you would experience your stress. Now, that third place is a decompression zone between the two. If you want to, you know, get a bit of time away from your family or your loved one or just get out of the home, you go to your third place. That might be a local pub. If you were living in New Yorkshire in the 90s, you would go to Central Perk and hang out with your friends Monica and Ross and Chandler and Joey and Phoebe, assuming that we're all Rachel here, guys. Now, we don't really have a third place these days. If you got a third place, would you say you had a third place aside from work and home?
Not really. I mean, when you were talking, I was thinking then, actually, is the beach, like living on a seaside town and the beach being that third place? Because in the winter when you go, and you said about the Wim Hof sort of approach and stuff, but actually there's been kind of a splurge in this area of, you know, like groups for men, groups for women, sort of taking some of that. And, you know, when I go to the beach, when it's not absolutely awful, but even when it's still blustery and cold, there are, you will see groups of people there together in social groups, congregating, going, having a sea swim, having a sauna, grabbing a coffee. Like, it is very much a social place around here.
I need a third place. I'm on the lookout for a third place. If my life right now was a Harry Potter book, it would be Vince Piat and the Search for the Third Place. Because I already developed
social
work.
Anyone will let you into the third place.
That sounds like an innuendo, doesn't it? That sounds like a really... Excuse me, can you please let me into your third place? Right, we're going to move on. Apart from the search for a third place... I've had a good week. I took my girlfriend to see James Blunt on Thursday. Now I've got a level where I thought I was too cool for James Blunt. When we go to a gig, I'll always buy her a t-shirt. I like doing that. You know, we've been to Sam Fender, I got her a t-shirt. Been to other gigs, got her a t-shirt. Went to 1975 not long ago, and I said, I'm not getting you a t-shirt, James Blunt. Why is that? I don't want people to know what the kind of folk that listen to James Blunt. Well, I stand corrected. I thought James Blunt's song were all like depressing, you know, you're beautiful, all this. Mm-hmm. I had a rip-roaring time. I had an absolutely excellent time at James Blunt's. So once, surprise, surprise, Cara, once again, a woman in my life has proved my stubborn views that are based on no evidence whatsoever other than my own outsized ego are incorrect. So I had a really good time.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, I've been getting to something new as well, a bit of a health kick. You're a healthy woman. You'll enjoy this one. Can I ask you a question about it?
Go on.
Have you ever slapped your lymph?
Slapped my lymph?
Slapped your lymph nodes?
Nodes? No. Right. I mean, I don't try and slap myself anywhere, really.
Well, I've been giving myself a good slap every morning for the past few days.
I mean, that would be satisfying to watch, if I'm honest.
So it's sort of self-flagellation, bang, like penance for my sins.
So what is the purpose of that?
Well, I'm deep. Whatever corner of Instagram reels I'm in,
right?
It's all ice baths, you know, yeah, get out there, e-commerce, yeah, buy Bitcoin, don't eat all the eggs you can eat, just eat grass-fed meat. Instagram evidently has sent me down that route. So I quite often get, you know, just, I mean, I've started taking this thing called black seed oil 2 weeks ago. I always get these new things. Do this. This will make you healthy. And to be fair, most of this stuff actually works. I do feel good. But I've gotten to this lymph slapping. So essentially, you've got different lymph nodes about your body. You've got them in your armpits. You've got them at the top of your chest. You've got them behind your knees. You've got them, the main ones that usually swell if you're ill, under your jaws. So this idea is that every morning you slap all of your lymph nodes 8 times. And no, you slap them eight times eight is 64. You slap your lymph nodes 64 times. You go around your body, you clap your hands 8 times and your inner arm, and you do that as a cycle. So I've been, every morning I've been slapping. My girlfriend got a bit embarrassed by me because I just learned about it, and I sometimes forget to do it. And I started doing it whilst we were waiting at the checkout for Lidl. And she's like looking at me like, what are you doing? I was just getting my slaps in. And I felt really sorry for the checkout, the lady on the checkout, because she was intentionally not looking at me, thinking that if I catch him in the eye, he might have some sort of episode. And I was thinking, I bet Lidl have specific training for folk like me, you know, and that she seemed to be following that training, which is if a customer is acting erratically, just ignore them. But I wasn't. I was just getting my lymph slapping. But yeah, if you do it in public.
I do get it, because you do have like lymph massage, don't you? And I do, oh God, is it Gouchoir? I'm going to absolutely murder that pronunciation, but it's where you use normally like a jade type tool to kind of drain the fluid from your face into your lymph nodes and like lymphatic draining. So I don't know, maybe you're crazy. Your crazy attempts. Well, you're gonna have to trial it and then let us know what difference it makes.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll take a video of myself when I'm doing it in the morning, and you can see how I go on. And just, you know, imagine me doing that in Lidl in front of you.
I will enjoy it muchly.
Yeah. Right, listeners, we do have a podcast to do, and it is about social work. Surprise, surprise. So let's crack on. This week's podcast comes off the back of a survey which was done on behalf of the Social Work Union in conjunction with the Independent newspaper. This survey can be found over at the Social Work Union's website, which is swu-union.org.uk. And this found that the cost of living crisis is significantly affecting social workers and the people they support. One of the headline takeaways, though, is that 92% of social workers surveyed believe that children would be better protected if caseloads were lighter. 58% of respondents said their caseloads were unmanageable. 86% of respondents said they expected referrals to increase next year. And it was decried that more funding is urgently required to help support issues. On a wider level, the survey found that almost 3/4 of adult, child and mental health social workers saw the people they support stop turning on their heating to save money over the winter. 60% increase in bills was having a significant effect on this. 15% of social workers reported seeing disabled people unable to charge their mobility devices due to the high cost of energy. And when put all together, 62% of social workers said their mental health was suffering. 86% of social workers said they suffer from stress of work, and 19% said they find themselves suffering an emotional response to their work, such as crying or feeling physically unwell at least once a week. Wow. Heavy reading, and this has obviously garnered a great deal of attention when we ran it. Wow. What do you think about that survey and its whole findings? Are those in keeping with your experiences of social work right now in spring 2024?
Yeah, I mean, it's depressingly obvious, if that's the way to kind of frame it. I just think nothing shocks me about that. But the fact that it doesn't shock me makes me feel just really depressed about the state of the current situation that the UK, but you know, worldwide. I'm sure if you did something similar, you probably see similar variations of that in terms of where we are. And in the UK, the cost of living crisis is just deeply depressing and undoubtedly impacts the work that we're doing and also what we're seeing. And yeah, I'm not shocked by it, but I do feel just overwhelmingly sad listening to that.
It's going to sound strange, this. In a way, it is heartening in one single way. Of course, look, it's obvious to say it's depressing. Of course it's depressing. Of course it's significant. But like you, Carol, you and I were talking about this 8 years ago. When we first met each other, we were talking about this 8 years ago. It hasn't changed. It's getting worse, but it's not changed. It's certainly not getting better. The reason why there's a small bit of me thinks, you know, this is heartening is I would be more concerned if this wasn't affecting social workers.
Yeah.
If people say, oh, well, you know, I'm blasé about this. This doesn't bother me. Now, people are going to think that's quite a twisted thing to say. So I need to be very, very clear. I don't want this to be happening. I don't want social workers to be adversely affected by this in terms of, you know, 20% of people crying in the office on a weekly basis. But we are human. What would we rather have? Social workers just not being emotionally affected by this? That's the norm. If you face crisis, it's the norm. The question is, though, you know, what's going to be done about it? Because, we've been talking about this for 8 years. It's very, very worrying indeed. In the time you've been a social worker, have you seen things improving? Have you seen things getting significantly worse? Or has it just been bobbing along?
It's difficult to almost like matrix map it, isn't it? Because I think there's areas of social work that are massively improved since I started. I think, you know, the way in which we practice the much more, especially, you know, that child focused and child centered way that organisations that I've worked with practice now is vastly different to when I first started. I think there's been lots of approaches that are very different, that are a lot more family-centred, and the attitudes around how we work with people, I think, are massively improved. I think, like you said, a lot of the themes in which are kind of addressed within that study aren't massively new pressures. But I think the way in which the cost of living crisis, I think what we talked about earlier around mental health and how like culturally we're changing as a group, has definitely gotten worse in my view, in kind of the reality of children being in poverty and the impact that children being in poverty has, the pressures that schools find themselves in. You know, every area of public service that you go to, it's pressured. And I feel for me, what is probably the worst is the rage in the system and how difficult.
What do you mean by that?
So I think like where everyone is stretched, you know, if you go to school, they're stretched. You go to the hospital, they're stretched. If you go to the mental health services, they're stretched. If you go, you know, no matter where you go, what resources you're looking for, whether you're looking for, you know, a foster home, whether you're going into the courts, whether you're talking to the police, everyone is stretched to beyond their means, and there is no give in the system. So the reality is then the rage from that and how people feel so utterly stressed and stretched that there is no give, and then it feels like there's a lot of anger. I think that's definitely gotten worse, in my opinion.
Where does that anger go?
I think directed at each other. I think I find meetings now very very fractious, and the ability to partnership work, which has always been an issue, let's be honest, like partnership work has always been difficult, but I think for me the how people are feeling that emotionally is definitely coming through in those discussions, in those decisions, because you're it's like that double whammy, isn't it, of what we're saying? We're talking about families that are in, you know, and children that are massively in these difficult situations, the emotional impact it has on seeing that and viewing that and being a part of that picture, and then really having very limited resources to offer to make that any better. And, you know, the recommendations where we need more resources, we need more this, we need more that. I've heard that, you know, a million times before. Mm. You know, we are in a situation where we're being told in all elements that there is no more give. And that just creates those sorts of emotional triggers and pressures for every professional around that table, whether they're a social worker or not.
It overspills, doesn't it? This drive to fix and this need for accountability, it's very, very difficult because ultimately, quite often, particularly in a multi-agency setting or particularly in settings where you have different teams, it does feel, rightly or wrongly for me, that there is this idea of who can we pass the buck to? Who is going to take responsibility for this? I would see this a lot, particularly, and this may chime with you, I would see this a lot, particularly when it came to teenagers who were at significant risk, but the risk they posed was mostly stemming from their own behaviors or their vulnerability. If the risk to children was posed by their parents, it was always kind of obvious what to do with that. Okay, the child can be placed, we can go through care proceedings. That's a relatively linear process, and there's a well-established track and a conveyor belt for that to happen. You know, issue proceedings, 26 weeks, parent assessments, yes or no, alternative care, family member, fostering, adoption. It's a flowchart. Where I found that that particular infighting came is when you were talking about children who perhaps required hospitalization regarding mental health issues, significant health issues that parents couldn't meet, children who were at risk due to own self-harming behaviors, suicidal attempts or suicidal ideation, children who were at complex risk of sexual exploitation or criminal exploitation, perhaps elements of dolls, deprivation of liberty, but no secure beds being found. It was those cases that were very fractious and fraught, which really, you should have seen people coming together. It was those cases where I saw more infighting and more division than anything else. Is that similar to you, or have you had different experiences?
Yeah, and I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head when you talk about that linear process. When there's a linear process and everyone knows what their responsibility is, it's like, oh, okay, we know what we're dealing with this. When there comes to kind of that problem solving, and maybe in those situations there's no one solution, that there's kind of going to have to be a myriad of different options, and people are going to have to come together. And it's almost like people kind of struggle with that sort of, oh, we don't have the time to think about this. One person has to be responsible. This is what we deal with. It's either a criminal thing, or it's a social thing, or it's a health thing. One person has to be responsible for that. That's how we deal with it. And there's a difficulty in that sort of joint commissioning of like, okay, what's the solution?
Yes.
And so that's why I think then people then become very dysregulated in being able to hold that and manage that. And so, yeah, I definitely think it's when we go outside of that linear process and that one person holding responsibility. And I think for social workers, unfortunately, is that because we tend to holistically work and look at the whole, that often that three quarters of the work tends to come our way, because we're kind of, you know, we have a remit, but also our remit kind of expands and is woolly and flexible and kind of moves and shapes and shifts and is a movable thing, where maybe other agencies have much more tighter remits and roles and responsibilities.
Well, I think not only do they have much more tighter remits, roles and responsibilities, they have a lot more professional clout. They have better unions, they have better representation, they have a better media image, they've got a bigger system behind them. You know, what chance has a local authority got going up against the NHS, which has over 1 million employees? What chance have we got going up against the police force when, you know, the police force have very clear laws and, you know, the police force will close ranks, are very, very supportive. What chance have we got going up an education system where, you know, we know time and time again that you're not going to win. You're not going to win a decision over a threshold when you've got it escalated to the head of the Academy Trust and you've got governors and, you know, God forbid the local MP gets involved, because it goes to that. Ultimately, we quite often back down and say, okay, we'll take it. We'll take it, because nobody else has assumed responsibility, so we do. The problem with that is we become the vessel to take everything. And if we're not getting adequate support from other people, no wonder we end up in situations where social workers are regularly crying in the workplace, because these are tragic situations. Now, of course, look, we're talking about extreme situations here. You and I, at our level of experience, we've seen those quite a lot. But most of our listeners maybe don't deal with that as much as we will, particularly in your role as a senior figure. You'll deal with that a lot. It's very difficult. And when you look at these figures, when you consider what we deal with, are we surprised that 20% of social workers are breaking down and crying and having physical ill effects because of the work on a weekly basis? Is that a shock for you?
Isn't a shock. But again, when I read that, I guess a little bit like you sort of taking that slightly different perspective to it, because I think there is times definitely in my social work career where I felt like crying was a really normal response to the situation and actually sometimes, you know, helpful, supportive, made me feel human, supported my sort of personal relationship, especially with young people, you know, when I've been in those sort of real life situations, when I've supported young people, when family members have died, when, you know, children that I've worked with have died for, illnesses and things like that, you know, that's a really normal response. And actually that's a really helpful thing to go through. And I would be really worried if we were being a part of those life stories and not having an emotional response to that, because once you're not connected emotionally, that's when I think it's really difficult to make decisions with people, alongside people, because you're not emotionally connected to the situation.
It's a hard balance, isn't it?
It's really hard.
To care enough to do your job well and to be able to have that empathy and build that connection with those that we support, but to almost be able to close down a certain aspect of your caring lest you crumble under the weight of vicarious trauma. It's a very, very hard balance to find. It really is. Because as a human, if you were to carry all of the pain that we see on a daily basis and to take the stories of your clients with you, you couldn't possibly function. Whereas if you go too far the other way and you don't let it bother you at all, then you're an awful social worker. You can't build connections with people, particularly if you're doing the work that I do, which involves sitting down with parents, most of whom have had their children recently removed from their care, and you have to ask them to recount the most harrowing details of their life and put together the aspects of their life that make up an assessment. It's hard to strike that balance. It really is.
Yeah, without a doubt, there's no real right answer to it. It's really difficult, isn't it? And it's really hard to explain to people where you build that resilience to that and where you emotionally almost kind of block it out and cut it off. But equally, I wouldn't want to remove the opportunity for people to be emotionally connected to those situations. No. It's kind of that, it's where does the professional line sit? And I think crying isn't necessarily a bad reaction to some of the things that we experience and are being a part of. And there will be things. It's really hard, isn't it, to explain to people that aren't involved in certain situations. Like, it's something that we hold as social workers, like why some things affect us more than others, and, you know, whether that's personally or just kind of the level of what you're seeing or kind of what you've been exposed to. But there are things that you will hear that other people, you know, your friends or family will hear and be shocked and appalled and really upset and distressed by, and it kind of doesn't really impact you. And then there will be other things that you might have heard 5 or 6 times before, but on that one occasion it just hits, and it's just difficult and much more emotionally difficult to kind of be resilient to.
And I think this is where we have to be aware of our own personal bias and our own personal prejudices, because we all have those. We can all pretend we don't have those, and it's all lovely to say we don't have those, but for me, the denial of how your lived experience shapes you as a person that is the dangerous thing. Admitting that, well, yeah, actually, do you know what I mean? My experience does make me feel this way, and I do have these standards because of my upbringing, and these things do affect me more. That's good. That's reflective practice. That is admitting you're a human. To deny that and say, no, I don't have any bias at all, that is incredibly dangerous indeed, because that will be subjugated. That will go somewhere, and you need to acknowledge your bias in order to be able to address it. If you don't, then it can be very dangerous indeed. For me, I fully accept that I have a great ability to work with fathers, particularly work with single fathers, because I was raised in a household with just my dad. It was just me and dad. So I get that experience. I grew up in very neglectful home conditions, so I get that experience as well. I grew up on a quite a rough council estate where most of my peers came from difficult backgrounds. There was a lot of drug use around me. People were going to prison around me. My friends ended up in prison. There was a lot of petty crime and antisocial behavior, but it was just my norm growing up. So that gives me a great ability to forge connections with certain sections of my client base. But I do have to be very, very wary of the impact that bias has upon me, because that bias has the risk of me normalizing what I saw in my childhood as normal, as being normal and effective and safe for the children that work of the day. Of course it isn't. But I think you have to acknowledge that bias, Cara. And I think there's no shame in acknowledging your bias. There's no shame, because this is how we were shaped. These were things we were thrown into. You know, I can't choose what happened to me as a child. I can't choose the environment that I grew up with. But I can't deny it either. And I can't pretend it didn't affect me, because that is where danger lies.
Yeah, I mean, you're spot on. I don't disagree with that at all. I think it's that, like you say, it's that asking those questions, isn't it? Am I thinking this? Am I feeling this? Because that's a normal reaction, or what my evidence tells me, what my assessment tells me is this because of what I've experienced or what I've seen? And having someone alongside you is really helpful to have that conversation and kind of throw that out there of like, is this a reaction that's normative? Is this normative?
Exactly.
Am I viewing this from a perspective that is unhelpful? I think that's what makes great social workers, is the ones that come from a lived experience perspective and can be empathetic and understanding, but equally understand their professional role. What does that look like? How does that impact on how they work, and ultimately they make the best social workers, in my view.
And I think you have to have time. I would say, I've said this before on the podcast, I would say it probably took me until I was around 6-7 years into my career where I kind of found my stride, where I found that balance between personality, professionalism, expertise, knowledge and training. Those things kind of came together. And it's a real tragedy because many people won't make it anywhere near that far, either before they leave social work entirely, move into a different field, perhaps go into management and are no longer able to influence clients on a direct level like the way they could. I think it's just a shame that we don't really give people the opportunity to grow. And I think this is made worse with, let's be honest, a lot of the time university experience doesn't adequately prepare people in terms of practice placements. I was sat with a third-year student today. I was observing father's contact with his children. I was sat with a third-year university student, and her placement in her third year was entirely with a family contact service. And I asked her, do you feel like you're getting relevant frontline experience? She says, no, I have to be honest, I'm not. You know, she's graduating. She'll be graduating and entering the workforce, you know, in 3 months' time. And her final placement is supervising contact. Now, look, supervision of family time is an incredibly important thing to do, but I would see that as maybe a first-year placement. You know, you're going to get elements of social work practice, but you're not going to do an assessment. You're not going to be out there, you know, in core groups and care teams. You're not going to be in those offices. You're not going to see the day-to-day push for social work practice. So This was an issue when I was trading 13 years ago. Sadly, still an issue now. Back to crying about work. This is the headline of this is going to be the headline, the title of the podcast is it okay to cry about work? Before I ask you that one, am I okay to ask you how often you've cried about work?
Oh, different periods of time. Definitely there was higher and lower levels of crying. I have to say what you said then really resonated around finding your stride and finding a way to manage my career alongside my personal life and not be crying all the time. And I think those first couple of years in social work, and I'm a practice educator, I've worked with a lot of students and as a manager, managed a number of ASYE, newly qualified social workers. And it's almost like, is it St. Paul's where the fish scales fall from your eyes and you see the world for the first time? And it's like,
now
that
you can
shock.
See.
Yeah, it's like the shell shock that, that people are experiencing coming into the world for the first time from lots of different varying backgrounds as well. So, I found the first couple of years really difficult. I was one of those students that never had a statutory placement during my training. I worked in a drug rehab and I worked for a youth group. Both I loved, absolutely loved the work, and it taught me a lot about working with, young people and adults and building relationships and person-centered practice. But in terms of actually being a social worker, I didn't have a Scooby-Doo when I walked in through that door and someone was like, here you are doing assessment. And I was a master's student as well, so everyone just assumed that I knew what I was doing when master's came out. And I was like, oh, I actually don't know what I'm doing. But yeah, I think in the early stages, I found it really difficult. And I guess there's a difference, isn't there? Because there were times where I cried because of what I was seeing and witnessing and observing and the connections I had with some of the young people that I worked with and kind of managing that. There was other times where I was crying because of the systems, because of the poor management of and I don't know, I was asking one of my friends the other day whether or not the social work floor was still the days where you got screamed at by a manager across the social work office. I don't know if that still flies in 2024, but it definitely existed when I started. I don't know if you ever felt that pain.
it's a very different culture now. I mean, look, obviously it depends on your manager. It depends on your manager, but I think the workplace culture as a whole in our entire society has changed, and I think there's a greater understanding of you have to treat your employees well. You can't be as harsh, particularly when, so good social workers, any social worker, but particularly good social workers, are in very short supply. I can't think of one social work interview apart from my very first one, which was 11 years ago now, where I was interviewed. All of the interviews I had were about the manager selling the job to me. They're trying to convince me.
Please, please.
It was like they're trying to convince me. I was like, wow, this is how different it is. I've never cried about work, though. I've never cried about work. I was thinking about this. I've been frustrated, I've been annoyed, I've been upset, I've been sad, but I don't know if it's because I'm such a bloody bloke that I can't let my feelings show, but I've never cried about work.
You cry personally? Are you a crier at a film, or is it, are you just not really a crier?
I cried the other night when I went to see James Blunt. Like I said at the start, I wasn't really aware of his songs beyond like 1973 and You're Beautiful and Bonfire Heart, kind of the big hits. And he sang this song called Monsters, which is about his father and, the death of his father and how he'll be there to chase the monsters away. And with my dad, having passed away 3.5 years ago now, it really, really touched me. So generally speaking, I will cry and can cry if it's to do with my children, if it's to do with my dad, and occasionally if it's to do with my girlfriend as well, particularly if like she's hurt or something's happened to her. But I don't know why I don't do it about work, because, the things that we see in work are horrific, but it's like I sometimes fear that if I open the door and I let that emotion in, Where does it stop? So it's kind of like, you know, yes, don't get me wrong, I'll be moved by things, I'm empathetic, I'm very grateful for the feedback I get in terms of how well my clients engage with me. And I genuinely do care, and I'm empathetic, and I share feelings, and I'm congruent, but I've always had an ability to kind of not let it get to the point where, you know, touch wood, I've ever burnt out, I've ever taken time off sick, I've ever kind of suffered significantly, I've never turned to drink or drugs or, you know, distractions or anything like that because of work. I've always kind of just, I've had this mentality to just keep going, just keep swimming. That's what I'm like. I'm like Dory.
Just keep swimming.
That's exactly, that is, I'm working on a book about social work at the moment. That's what I might call it. I might call it just keep swimming. That is my attitude. You know, just keep swimming. Do we think, though, that there is a stigma to showing emotions in social work? Maybe that's what it is. Maybe I suffer from a kind of internal stigma because I did come from this tough, macho background, being raised by a single father who was a coal man, you know, and having friends that were all into the gym and all fighting and doing rough stuff. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe there's a stigma to me crying. Do you think there is a stigma in general to showing our emotions in social work? Should we be these stoic characters, or is it okay to have a little cry every now and again?
It's a tough one, really, because in some respects, I think there is. And I think there is an element, because there's an element of letting the work get to you. And that sort of, like you say, that sort of, you know, are they going to go off sick? Oh, God, what, you know, if you go off sick, then, you know, we have to take up the slack. You know, it's that sort of, I guess people are almost like panicked, aren't they, about too much emotion, and are they going to struggle? And there is that sort of thing of like, if you can't manage this work, maybe it's not for you. It's that sort of, especially in, depending on what sort of team you're working in. But then so crying is somewhat normative enough that we can joke universally about there being a crying cupboard in the office, in a social work office, and people will go, oh yeah, I know where we all go to cry. Like, so it's kind of weird, isn't it? Because it clearly happens. People are clearly aware of it. You know, the report is sharing that happens. We know that it's a universal thing, but we almost don't accept it. We don't appreciate it. And there is that sort of, there, you know, oh God, how is this going to affect me if she's not okay? So yeah, I think there is a bit of a stigma to it, and I think there is a thing, because there is that thing of, let's just keep on swimming. Well, you know, what about the next thing? You know, you don't have time really.
That's it. You don't got situation time,
because, you know, I need that report on my desk tomorrow. You know, that we've got court tomorrow. We've got this tomorrow. We've got, you know, you need to be driving that child up to Newcastle tomorrow. Like, that's definitely, that's definitely, like, I think the pace of the work doesn't really allow for that either.
And that is a very good point. We did every Monday, we do an opinion column here at Social Work News, where myself and Tilly Baden and Matt Bate, two other of our podcast co-hosts, we'll answer questions. And this Monday just gone, the question was, do social workers get enough leave? And I don't believe we get nowhere near enough leave. And I believe that leave in social work is kind of seen as almost a reward. Well, for me, it's a kind of necessity. We have to have that time out. Saying that, I think the last time I had a day off was around Christmas, but let's not go there. Let's not go there. This isn't about this. Do what I say, not what I do, listeners. I just keep swimming. Might work for me. Maybe it doesn't work for everybody else. But no, you make a very fair point. You make a very fair point in the fact that, are we afforded that time for reflection? Because many, many people may be in the same position I find myself in to cope with it, which is just find the next thing, do the next thing, because that can be effective. That can be effective, that fixation on the next task, the next deadline, the next activity. If you don't spend too much time dwelling on things, yeah, because some problems will go away. That's the truth of the matter. You know, as a manager, you'll know this all too well, Cara. Sometimes people will email you things, and if you don't reply in a couple of days, they'll come back and say, never mind, I've worked it out for myself. Well, worries can kind of work like that as well. And I think you do have to be selective in a certain sense. I was watching a video the other day that was talking about, it's normal to have worries. It's just normal. Everybody has worries, everybody has fears, everybody has anxieties. That's normal. But sometimes talking about these things might not be effective. You maybe just can let it go. And perhaps could that be an effective tactic in social work? Because if you go the other way, if you find yourself caring too deeply about everything, then are you even going to be able to do the job?
I mean, you are, like you said, at the very beginning, it's a balancing act, isn't it? And I think
exactly that.
With all of this, it's a balancing act. You know, if you need to have a little cry, have a little cry. There's nothing, you know, like I said, sometimes a little cry does just make you better. It gets all these little emotions out, little cry in the crying cupboard, sort yourself out, go to the junk table, have a little cake, sit at your desk, crack on with the next report.
Get yourself down the sea sauna on a Sunday.
Exactly.
Give your lymph nodes a good slap. Yeah, baby, I'm buying into it. We are the hardworking, crying, saunering, junk-eating, lymph-slapping, rock and roll social workers. That's what we are. That's the people we are. This is just what we do.
Yeah, how we cope, all the weird things we do to find a way to find that work.
Cupboards, yellow labeled donuts, we slap our nodes, we sweat it out on the sea with women we've never met before, and we talk about it every Wednesday night on a podcast. This is just what we do. Welcome to the show. I'm gonna see if Nick Farrer, my good friend and our editor at Social Work News, she also produces the podcast as well. I'm going to see if Nick could maybe clip what I've just said out there. Maybe that could be like a trailer. This is just what we do. We are the lip-stabbing, sea-saunering, rock and rolling, junk food eating, cupboard crying, SWR. I've borrowed that. That's what Bruce Springsteen says at the end of his... any Bruce Springsteen fans may be aware of what I've done there. I have paraphrased and emulated what the boss says at the end of his concerts about the E Street Band. I've just realised I'm seeing Bruce Springsteen in 6 weeks' time. How exciting.
Yes. Will you get a T-shirt?
Yeah, obviously it's the boss. I love the boss. He's the only boss. I used to have a T-shirt, which, because Bruce Springsteen's known as the boss. I used to have a T-shirt which says, the only boss I listen to.
I'm just imagining just having to be your manager at any point. And just the impossibility of like supervision and being like, right, but go on, you crack on.
As I walk into your office slapping myself about my limps.
Yeah, it'd just be like, right, supervision, I'm going to have to really brace myself for this one.
And then I start telling you how to do your job. Well,
yeah.
Well, he's a list.
I come out of a to-do list. I'm like, what? What's going on here?
This is probably where I'm best suited to being self-employed, to be honest.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Free man.
We'll end on this one then. What can we do to address some of the issues raised by this survey? We're not going to tackle a big one, which is societal poverty and massive imbalance between the haves and have-nots. I haven't slapped enough lymph nodes to be ready for that one, to be honest. Let's just focus on, you know, the 20% of social workers being so affected by their work that they will cry at work or be physically affected. Okay, some of that's normal. Let's accept some of that's normal. But if people don't want to feel that way and believe that those are negative emotions that they are only experiencing because of insurmountable pressures, how can we address that? How can we make life and work a little bit easier for some of these social workers that are suffering dreadfully at the current time?
I think it's about finding, like you said earlier, that balance, that emotional connection balance, that, you know, I mean, we could use all the usual things of what I would be saying is, you know, you need to talk it out and say, actually, I'm overwhelmed by this. I need support with this. This is what I'm not managing with. You know, is there scope within the system to have that support and that that opportunity to share some of that burden? Ultimately, if you're not getting that from within the work that you're doing in that particular role, there are lots of different social work roles and that can be fulfilling. And, you know, I've left roles that I felt overwhelmed by that, you know, they weren't satisfactory to me, and found other roles that I absolutely flourished and didn't, you know, kind of found my niche and loved and still work within. So I think there's an element of personal responsibility of, this isn't working for me. I can't continue in this level. And if it's scoping into the role of I can't manage it, I can't find a way in which to address that, then, you know, embracing what is social work, what is your passion, what are you interested in, what do you want to be doing, and finding something that kind of meets that. But yeah, it's really hard, isn't it? Because it's all very individual. But for me, it's about reaching out, talking about it. And if you don't get that reception from your manager about that, then maybe there's something else that you need to look into.
Within social work or something else you need to look into, like go and set up a seesaw on a business.
Setting up a seesaw. Well, I think, you know, because we talked about self-care before and all of those things being really important and building on that resilience. And there is a level of personal responsibility you have to find within that, you know, and finding what you are or aren't distressed by, and building up your cup so that you can, in order to be an effective practitioner. And if you're not managing, then being responsible for saying that and having, you know, clear boundaries around what you are or aren't managing. But equally, if you get to a point where you've done all those things, you've tried to fill up your cup as much as possible, you've gone to your manager, you've said, I'm not coping with this, I'm not coping with that, this is, you know, and they're coming back saying, well, you know, that's kind of the job, that's it, then it's your opportunity then to look at what else is out there that might be more fulfilling for you, that might be more manageable, because not all social work roles are fit for everyone, you know, they're all very different experiences.
I think that's very, very true what you've said there, in terms of, you know, sometimes you just have to accept it's not for you.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to cut your losses. And I think this applies to life in general. We get this idea sometimes in life, and this, I think it's particularly prevalent in relationships and work, this one is, and it's the time sink fallacy. We believe that because we've sank 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, 9 years, even 1 year, whatever we want to define it, we sometimes convince ourselves as human beings that because we've put so much time into something, whether that's work, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a hobby, whether it's a friendship, whether it's committing to our neighbors and family members, whatever it is, that even if it's not working out for us, we think, well, actually, I've spent so much time on this thing, I may as well keep going, almost to justify the time that we have spent. But it's far better to be at the bottom of a ladder that you want to climb than halfway up one you don't. Because sometimes you just have to cut your losses and say, well, okay, that's it. You know, because at the end of the day, you are replaceable as social workers. Look, every single social work job I've ever left has replaced me. Now, of course, I will say that no one was as good as
me.
They've got a blue plaque for me on every single wall. They've probably got a sign at the front desk saying, don't let this man in. It's probably like pub watch. Don't let this man back. I joke. I'm very, very grateful in the fact that I've left. Never had a bad reference. I've left all my employers on very good terms. Indeed, I'm very, very grateful for that, because I always give people time, because it's, look, no matter how difficult a time I've had in a workplace, it's my clients that I do things right by. So I'm very grateful on a serious note. But yes, time sink. I think we have to be very, very careful of justifying continuing going down a path we don't want to go down because of the time we've spent in. Almost, well, we have to justify this time. Look, you may be the best social worker in the world. You will be replaced. You will be replaced in any job, but you'll never be replaced as a father or a mother or a friend or a sister or an auntie or an uncle or a cousin. The people in your life that rely upon you and value you, they will miss you when you go. They will be the ones that pick up the pieces when you burn out. Now, of course, we have supportive employers and HR would help us out. And I'm sure that any good manager like yourself, Cara, would care about, you know, their staff and want to give them a ring if they're doing unwell. But you're not going to be there for them to hold their hand in the middle of the night when they're having a crisis. You simply can't be. That's not your role. You would be frowned upon if you try to do that as a manager or a fellow employee. The point of all this is, as you say, if things are getting far too bad for you in the workplace, consider leaving. Okay, you may have to take a wage cut. Well, what changes can you make in your life? Do you really need that brand new car? Do you really need that new phone? Can you downsize a house? Because The older I get, the more I realise that life is far too short to waste it being unhappy in the pursuit of accolades that you don't really want, money that isn't helping make up for sadness, and achievements that are being made on behalf of somebody else.
Yeah, and I don't even know if it's that you need to leave social work. Sometimes it's just leaving a different, you know, and not necessarily having to take a cut of money. Every time I've left a role, I've always kind of been more financially more stable and secure. It's about finding what works for you, isn't it? There's lots of different avenues. There's lots of different opportunities. Like, social work is such a broad thing. I mean, we often talk about children's social work because we have been children's social workers for our careers, but it's just such a huge, you know, I stepped into suicide prevention 2 years ago, and it's an amazing, it's an area that I never worked in before and I absolutely love. And I would never have known that unless I'd taken the opportunity, and I wasn't unhappy where I was. I'm still in the same organization, but it's just such a broad, wide, varied, exciting career and profession to be a part of. So if it's not working for you in a particular team or in a particular area, try something else, because there is roles that will bring you back to life and make you feel connected back to why you became a social worker in the first place.
We are a welcoming church. We are a wide and varied and many splendid profession. And as one of our fellow co-hosts, Tilly Baden, will always tell us whenever this subject arises, she will remind everyone that she started out as a children's social worker. She was in it for a year. She found it very difficult, and now she's absolutely thriving and flying in the upper echelons of management with an adult social work. And Matt B, one of our co-hosts, will say the same. He was in statutory social work. Now he's operating as a social worker, but in a non-statutory role. And there is something for everybody. On that note, listeners, thank you ever so much for tuning in. As always, do head over to mysocialworknews.com to check out the articles relating to this. Also, check out the opinion column I was talking about earlier, which went out this Monday, just gone. You can also follow us across social media channels. Search for Social Work World or Social Work News. You will find us there. Cara and I will be back next week. Until then, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.